live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Nick Zitzen, John McCarron, and Art Sear. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the new Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, the web address, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, tonight we're going to be talking about presidential politics, as we have been for the last several weeks, and as we will for the next 52 weeks, or maybe even longer than that. Obviously, big news is that in the Iowa straw poll, which usually gets a lot of press as a forerunner to the presidential campaign in 2012, Mitt Romney and Michelle Bachmann are tied in a Des Moines Register poll that came out just yesterday. Also, John Huntsman, another Republican, is in that race. We'll talk about what that means and whether or not his foreign policy expertise really could change the tone of the Republican debate and debates that are before us. And we'll also talk about Afghanistan, Libya, and the breakdown of the budget talks congressionally, what all that means. As we start our discussion this evening, we welcome Nick Zitzen. He's our card-carrying Republican tonight. Once upon a time, you worked for the Republican Party. You were the political director of the Republican Party in Massachusetts. Mitt Romney was your boss. You were his chief scheduler. You worked for him for a long time. So you're the first bona fide Romney supporter that we've had sit in that Republican seat on a Sunday night. So my question to you is, I'm going to ask you to begin by offering your assessment of the launch of the John Huntsman campaign, now that people know that you might be somewhat skewed in your analysis.
Thanks, Bruce. I think there are two points about the Huntsman launch that are noteworthy, not the least of which is, number one, that his campaign got off to a bit of a rocky start when it comes to the logistics. Now, this is a nationally syndicated radio show. There's a lot of moving parts that go into putting this program on the air every Sunday. Similarly, there are a lot of moving parts that go into launching a presidential campaign. And something as simple as, how do you label the press who come up to cover the event? You hand out credentials, and in the case of Governor Huntsman's campaign, those credentials spelled his name incorrectly. So I don't mean to make too much of that. It's a small issue, but at the same time, I think whether or not candidates are ready for a national campaign is a fair issue, and I think in his case, that question has yet to be answered.
John McCarron, where would you put Huntsman? I mean, obviously a long shot, but is he a long, long shot, or is there a way in which someone who appears to be somewhat cerebral can get an attention and traction in a more combustible field?
Well, from what I read, as a primary candidate, he's a very long shot. And more's the pity, Bruce, because from what I read also, he's, you know, a very capable centrist kind of guy. And I would say would be elbow to elbow with Mitt Romney in a lot of categories in terms of intellectual capacity and governmental experience. And, you know, he's a Mandarin speaker. I mean, he's really got the big picture. But we're talking Republican primary, are we not? And it seems like the bomb throwers, so to speak, the people who can best appeal to the Tea Party are the ones who are moving to the fore, which is a shame.
When you talk about the bomb throwers, Art Sear from Carthage College, I want to get your reaction, picking up on a point that John made, is that when you hear the term bomb throwers in the Republican primary field, can you be a bomb thrower? Are you considered a bomb thrower if your foreign policy is really calling for a more isolationist position for the United States?
Yes, in the sense that that's a remarkable change from the status quo, including the status quo within the Republican Party.
But a presidential
Party.
Election isn't, shouldn't it be about serious discussions like that?
Yeah, absolutely. You're saying, should you be called a bomb thrower if you're talking about serious policy issues?
Yes.
Well, it's the tone, I think, more than the substance of the Tea Party that leads to that kind of pejorative description. It's highly emotional. It's very extreme. They don't actually talk much about foreign policy. It's much more a domestic tax revolt,
but
which
Mitt
is
Romney,
well established in our
Mitt
history.
Mitt Romney was the guy that brought it up in the debate in New Hampshire.
He sure did.
Everybody else sort of jumped on with a similar position, but it seems to me that that's not a position that is necessarily that far out of the mainstream Republican thinking in 2011.
I think that's the interesting thing. Regardless of whether or not it is, the only thing that matters to mainstream Republican ideology in the lead up to 2012 is who's the best candidate to position the Republican Party on the economy, Bruce. And I think that's why Mitt Romney continues to run number one in pollings and polling surveys. I think that's why he raises a lot of money. I think that's why a lot of activists who maybe at the beginning of this cycle questioned whether or not he was the right fit, but now believe increasingly that he is, because he's the strongest on the economy.
Explain to the audience, you have two Mormons, both strong family men, one the former governor of Utah, obviously Mitt Romney, the governor of a different state, but somewhat of a folk hero in Utah for what he did with the Olympics. So what's the politics of Mormonism and the politics of Utah politics, where Romney has been very strong in the past as well. But these guys are, and again, you might each describe them as sort of, at least stylistically, country club looking Republicans.
I think that's fair. I think that there was an interesting exchange. Any Republican candidate who announces typically goes on Sean Hannity's program and does an interview, and Governor Huntsman did this past week, and the issue of Mormonism came up, and the conversation continued on after the candidate left the program. And there's this real tension between evangelical Christians who view skeptically or suspiciously the Mormon Church, but at the same time believe that the economy is a crucial issue. So my hope is, Bruce, different than in the cycle 3 years ago when Mitt Romney was confronted, that the economy will win out and voters who might view the church of Latter-day Saints with some skepticism will put that aside and give candidates the chance to talk about issues and not faith.
But reality, politics, does Huntsman and Romney, do they run the risk of splitting the Mormon vote and Michelle Bachmann or someone else sneaks in and wins the nomination, John?
Well, we're talking again about the sort of the bizarre politics of the Republican primary, and particularly
I think we're talking about splitting the vote amongst the constituency that can only vote once.
What I was going to say is that most Americans have put religion are beyond religion as they are now beyond sexual proclivity.
You think that's the case in Republican primaries?
No. That's what I'm saying. We have this bizarre situation where you have to be kind of an extremist. You have to be a right-wing extremist to do well in the Republican primary, but that's not the kind of person who probably can do well against Barack Obama in the fall.
Why is it that you use the term right-wing extremism?
Because there are candidates.
Let me just finish my point. If someone disagrees with one's religion. Now, you can say that might be bigoted, but is that an extreme position? I mean, Nick was saying that, you know, evangelicals have problems with Mormonism. So are all Christians, are all evangelicals extreme? That's the question. I want to give a chance to respond to that when we come back. From Salt Lake City to Boston, Massachusetts, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289 on America's great radio stations every Sunday night, as well as Sirius and XM satellite radio. John McCarron, before the break, you had made a comment about right-wing extremism, and I was detecting that you were sort of using that broad brush to describe those who are evangelicals.
Well, I was suggesting that most of America is beyond religion, and is beyond race, and is beyond sexual disposition in terms of evaluating candidates. But I suspect that voters in the Iowa Republican primary, most of them are probably not. Yeah. They probably have issues with all those.
But again, if you're talking about a Republican primary that is going to select one of the two people that is most likely to be the president of the United States, then those issues are very important and very relevant. And as long as they're important and relevant to that sector that determines who one of the combatants is in the big battle, then those become very important issues. And my question was one of mathematics, is that if the Republican primary, or even a portion of the Republican primary, turns into a debate and discussion about religion, or, you know, whose religion is better, and you have two Mormons in the race, those two Mormons, their votes could offset one another, and someone from some other religion, whether it's Michelle Bachmann or someone, Tim Pawlenty, I mean, it seems to me there's an opportunity for them just mathematically to sneak in and capture the Republican nomination.
I'm not so sure there's that big a Mormon vote in Iowa, for instance, to be split, yeah. Bruce.
May not just be Iowa, but you're right.
We're talking about a very small population, which is heavily concentrated in Utah. I think it's more likely, using your term, to divide the bomb thrower vote. Whatever hostility is focused on that particular minority will be diffused.
But my point is, it's not where the Mormons are. The Mormons are a relatively small number. And again, should they be split between Romney and Huntsman, that could be a problem for each of them. I'm talking about the people that Nick referred to, and Nick, you can follow up. I'm talking about the people out there who really will never vote for a Mormon. They're going to make their choice based on religion, first and foremost.
Let's be, Mitt Romney faced this problem 3 years ago, and that's why Mike Huckabee swept into Iowa at the last minute and won the caucuses. But Mitt Romney continued to be competitive in other states.
Yeah.
John McCain went on to win the nomination, not exactly, somebody who won on the basis of his religious credentials. Yeah. I think the test for Mitt Romney or for John Huntsman or for any candidate who is considered to be a mainstream conservative, can you win primaries in the North, in the South, in the East, in the West? That's it. Can you put the geography together? Can you have the right map to get you the nomination? And Mitt Romney, I think, has shown signs of making inroads, and I think he remains far enough above John Huntsman in terms of visibility that any offset to having Huntsman in the race is probably minimal.
Mm-hmm. And does everybody at this table agree that it is going to be the economy that's going to define the campaign, and that gives a leg up to Romney?
And more specifically, unemployment. Actually, the economy is doing, in terms of expansion, relatively well, and that's underreported. But if unemployment is still above 9%, I think Obama's finished. It's remarkable how little we're talking about foreign policy. We're talking about the Kennedy-Nixon debate. You have a great display downstairs. One reason why Nixon looked irritable and resentful during that first debate was he often looked that way, but also they were supposed to be talking about domestic issues, and Jack Kennedy kept driving the debate into foreign policy.
We're going to talk
180 degrees.
We're going to talk more about foreign policy as the program unfolds,
right.
But let's just talk about sort of the breakdown in the budget discussions in Washington, D.C., and where the issues, the debate over the debt ceiling and some of these issues are likely to come down, and is there going to be a clear winner? Is somebody going to be one side won, one side lost, or is it going to be a pox on both houses? Art?
I think it's going to be a short-term deal. I think if we don't reach a deal, the voters will say a pox on all your houses. John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, has a remarkable opportunity, I think, to return the office to what it was up until the last few decades, which is a relatively nonpartisan office in the Congress. I think there's a lot that's very impressive about him, including the fact that he used to work as a salesman and a bartender. We tend to be sarcastic. Those are very tough jobs. And increasingly, Washington is a millionaire's club with people who haven't done that kind of work.
Do you buy that assessment, and do you buy the assessment of Boehner as the speaker at this moment?
Yeah, I buy it. I think it has merit. I think the challenge when it comes to raising the debt ceiling is that you have a large class, particularly in the Republican Party, of freshman members of Congress who believe that they were sent to Washington to derail issues that would normally be considered mainstream Washington compromise issues. Like, if we raise the debt ceiling, then we get a few things and you get a few things. So I think Boehner could very well set himself up to serve as a statesman. I just think his own caucus is going to be the single biggest impediment to that, because this is a caucus that's looking to make a big statement, and I don't think they believe compromise equates a big statement.
John, you agree with that?
Well, yeah, Dan's right. So far, or I should say Nick is right. So far, Boehner is lining up with the most extreme elements of his caucus, the Tea Party freshmen. Here's what's going to happen, Bruce. I think they're going to go right to the wire. I think they're going to go beyond the wire. I don't think they're going to raise the debt ceiling. And then I think the phones are going to start ringing, and the Wall Street Republicans are going to call in and say, fellas, we're not able to meet, the Treasury Department isn't paying interest on T-bills. They stopped. The money market funds are breaking the buck. They're not, just anathema to financial markets. And I think ultimately the Wall Street folks are going to be heard and pressure Mr. Boehner et al., and they'll come around to reasons light.
Jim DeMint, the senator from South Carolina, has suggested that what we may be on the verge of is the breakup of the Republican Party. If the Wall Street Republicans and the Tea Party Republicans can't get along, and I don't think there's been any signal that suggests that they really can, I mean, literally the party could disintegrate, couldn't it?
No, I think the Tea Party group could leave the Republican Party. And that might be a plus overall. The Tea Party-endorsed candidates lost, two-thirds of them lost in the House races. Up in Wisconsin, our new Republican Senator Ron Johnson very ostentatiously refused to join the Tea Party caucus. What's interesting to me is that given the rich history in the U.S. of third-party movements, that the Tea Party types have been operating within the Republican Party so far.
Do you think that that there's a possibility that the party could suffer irreparable harm by not being able to come together on this in some way?
I think there's a possibility the Republican Party could be in for a rude awakening if it doesn't figure out how to take this raw emotion, which is what the Tea Party sort of represents. I mean, make no mistake, these people, I don't necessarily know that extreme characterizes them correctly. I think they're nervous. I think they're intimidated and scared about what they fundamentally
– angry,
that's right. And
Fear. Fear itself.
Absolutely. I think that's a powerful thing. I think the Republican Party's got to find a way to deal with that and make them believe that the Republican agenda can capture that fear and turn it into something that's meaningful. If they can do that, if Boehner can do it, if Eric Cantor can do it, if Mitt Romney can do it, the Republican Party will run strong. If not, we've got another thing coming.
All right, you're talking about the Tea Party folks leaving the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if the other wing ends up leaving the Republican Party. Do they consider going independent?
No. You mean middle of the road and relatively liberal Republicans?
Middle of the road?
I'm not a politician.
Wall Street crowd, do they seek this new center force that is, moderates multiply?
Corporate America is not partisan, Bruce. They follow the money. And, in fact, corporate PACs, depending on who's in power, give more to Democrats than Republicans. This is not an automatically Republican crowd. This is a capitalist crowd, which means I'm interested in money. I have no ideology.
Well, what I'm saying
is, capitalist.
Would they end up getting more money if they created a new party? If the Republican Party is going to be so dominated by forces that they don't like, and don't even want to be in the same room with them, you've suggested that maybe it's the firebrands that lead the party. I'm thinking maybe it's the old gray suits that leave the party. John?
I think the
Certainly they left the party, and a lot of them supported Barack Obama last time. They didn't leave the party, but they left the party on Election Day.
I think the blue-stockinged folks will keep the brand. We'll keep the Republican brand. It's more likely that the Tea Party people would splinter. And, Bruce, this transcends the debt limit thing. I mean, this gets back to the budget thing. Who do you think ends up with the money that's spent on Medicare and Medicaid? Sick people or subsidies to the oil industry or to ethanol or ag subsidies? I mean, this is part of the Republican Party that really, doesn't listen to a lot of talk radio because they're busy making money in their offices and whatnot. They're not going to go, be demanding extreme budget cuts. It's the money that flows through to them.
What's an extreme budget cut?
What's an extreme budget cut? I would say capping and vouchering out Medicare would be an extreme approach.
What's an extreme budget cut, Nick?
I don't know that we've ever seen an extreme budget cut that's not related to Department of Defense spending, because DOD spending is the only thing that's discretionary to the point where you can get into those big numbers. Discretionary spending in this country is small money, and we just haven't seen anything that even rises to that level when it comes to cuts.
I want to hear your definition of an extreme budget cut, and wherever you're listening from coast to coast, let's get your definition of an extreme budget cut. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for being with us tonight. From Los Angeles to Alamogordo, New Mexico, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Around the table this evening, we have John McCarron. John McCarron is a longtime columnist for over 30 years. He was a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, many years serving on the editorial board, now does some contributing work for the Tribune, but he is an adjunct professor of journalism at DePaul University, and he is teaching young journalists to think beyond the box. Is that true?
Yeah. They already know how to upload videos on the web, and I don't. But I know how to get into the cloakroom of City Hall, council chambers, and schmooze aldermen. That's what I'm trying to teach them.
Why does a young student want to be a journalist today, based on your students?
Certainly the opportunities were never greater in terms of the vehicles that they can get into. I mean, virtually everybody can be a journalist today.
And you don't have to go to school, right?
That would be one of the meanings, Bruce. When I started, there was a priesthood, and you had to go to the University of Missouri or Northwestern or Columbia, someplace to get to be a bishop in the order of journalists. Those days are long over. Now anybody can do it. But to get a pay job, it probably does help for your resume to have some journalism school background, school newspaper background, and a clip file.
Also with us this evening is our Republican. He is Nick Dzitzon. He is the chief operating officer of the Bronner Group. And in 50 words or less, what is the Bronner Group?
Bronner Group's a consulting firm that actually works with governments in the areas of strategy, transformation, and accountability.
Right. And Gila Bronner, who is your boss, she has been a guest on this show many times. And once upon a time, Nick was the political director of the Massachusetts Republican Party, and he was also a scheduler and an aide to Mitt Romney when he's the governor, and then he also worked for Tommy Thompson when he was the Secretary of HHS in Washington, D.C., also did some work in the Justice Department. Let's go back to Mitt Romney a little bit before I introduce Art. How did you meet Mitt Romney, and how did you end up being – you were his chief scheduler, is that correct?
Actually, director of appointments in the sense we went out and found people to appoint to state boards commissions, so it's more like a recruiter.
Okay.
Romney was running the Olympic Games in 2002 when Jane Swift, who was the acting governor of Massachusetts, wasn't very popular. Romney was coached back into Massachusetts politics to run for governor, and I was one of the first people on that campaign.
Okay, but how did you meet him at that point?
Oh, it's interesting, actually.
And you're from Massachusetts.
I am from Massachusetts, right? Yep. I actually remember Mitt when he ran against Ted Kennedy in 94, which is how Mitt got his statewide political start.
Right.
And then when he came back and started his campaign for the governor, for the first month and a half of that campaign, courtesy of my relatively young age, I was his driver. And let me tell you, you don't get a chance to know somebody until you've driven them around in a campaign setting. He's a terrible backseat driver, by the way. Don't let him tell you different.
And if he became president of the United States, when was the last time you talked to him?
I talked to him a few months ago when he was in Chicago.
So would you likely have a position if he became president of the United States?
Oh, I think it's way too early for that. But if Mitt Romney won the presidency, I'd certainly wouldn't put it past him to recruit the very best and the brightest. You could take that to me whenever you'd like.
Well, either that, he could be his driver again.
No, the Secret Service does that.
I know that. Yeah. That job is taken.
Yeah. They won't let you near the whale.
And Art Sear also joins us. He is the A.W. Clawson Distinguished Professor at Carthage College. That is in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And Mr. Clawson is one of the founders of Bank of America, or one of the leaders of Bank of America.
Not one of the
and
founders.
And the World Bank. Not one of the founders. That was the Giannini family?
That's right.
Peter Giannini, right? San Francisco.
Got their big boost in the earthquake of 1906. It was the working person's bank. We were talking about class differences before. And they got a huge boost. The bank vault was open, and the building was destroyed in 1906. And Mr. Giannini put two crates and a board out in front of the destroyed building and made loans to people.
The people stole the money, did you say?
There was a lot of theft that went on, but he made
the
right move in the midst of that.
So it became the People's Bank for a while.
It was already the People's Bank, but it suddenly became a much more popular bank.
And the Giannini family was also one of the early families that supported Ronald Reagan for governor of California and the presidency of the United States.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Well, Clawson was nominated to be head of the World Bank. He was there in between Robert McNamara and Barbara Conable.
But no relations to the Pickle Company?
No. And a different name.
Okay.
It shows you know all kinds of things, Bruce.
Just checking.
McNamara retired for his own reasons late in the Carter administration, and the new head of the World Bank had to be somebody who was congenial to Ronald Reagan as well. Clawson was nominated by Carter, but in fact, if you're smart enough to become head of Bank of America, you're smart enough to know the governor of California. So they had a good rapport.
Because it is, and this is something that I know that, John, you wanted to talk about, because of the decision this past week in the state of New York, where gay marriage will soon be legal, and in Chicago it is Gay Pride Sunday, which is gets a lot of publicity in this market. Are you surprised at the speed with which the issue of gay marriage has really, although a lot of people are opposed to it, vehemently opposed to it, are you surprised at the legislative response and the speed with which it has grown since it first occurred in Massachusetts years ago?
I was at one time, but I think what happened is you saw some veteran, savvy political people embrace the gay movement, and I'm thinking mainly of Mayor Richard M. Daley, or former mayor. It's hard for me to say. Not say Mayor Daley, but Dick Daley in Chicago, Rich Daley embraced the gay community here, and there was an outpouring for him.
But there is no gay marriage in Illinois.
But because there's downstate Illinois, which is very, very rural and very Republican, kind of a small town attitudes prevail. But there is a bonanza, I think, in certainly in many metropolitan urban areas, is a political bonanza that awaits office holders, politicians who embrace gay America. Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to Massachusetts, because Massachusetts was the first state that legalized gay marriage. You were in the state when that happened, and Romney was the governor when that happened. How did that happen? Because Romney worked very hard to stop it. Tell us about what was happening in the state or the Commonwealth of Massachusetts during that time.
Well, I'm glad you asked the question, because I actually think the two situations, New York and Massachusetts, are very different. In Massachusetts, as you recall, it was the state's Supreme Judicial Court who ruled on the issue and, in effect, legalized gay marriage by court decision. Governor Romney, I think, sort of came out very strong, opposed to the decision, not only because he believed marriage was between a man and a woman, but because he believed that the issue, should it take place, should be legislative and not judicial. So in New York, regardless of what you think of the issue, I think it belongs as a legislative action. If the state legislature in New York wants to do it, that's their prerogative, and it's up to their constituents to decide whether or not they agree with the actions of the state legislature.
And it was the decision of that Supreme Council in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that not only led to the political firestorm that followed there, but then you had the George Bush White House react, or someone would say overreact, and that's when they wanted to put the amendment on so many different states, which ultimately led to George Bush's election.
Absolutely, and I think overreaction probably isn't accurate at all if you're measuring it in political validity. I mean, Karl Rove is a smart man, and he knew very well that if you could get people in key Bush states passionate about a particular issue, and gay marriage is an issue that stirs a lot of passion, the more you do to broaden that issue, the better you do to turn out voters.
In a game of what if the Massachusetts Supreme Council had not voted that way and had not given Karl Rove what he needed to exercise and increase turnout, wouldn't Al Gore have been president of the United States?
John Kerry?
Wouldn't he have, won that race?
It certainly would have been a whole lot closer.
Art, where do you come down on this?
The swing population is women. And in 2004, it was white women.
What do you mean that?
In terms of the swing.
The
most
swing
important
vote population.
Yes, and to give you a direct.
Put it in context of our discussion here.
Wider issues. In 2004, a bare majority of white women, just narrowly but slightly over 50%, voted for President Bush and the Republican Party. Since the late 60s, women have been increasingly independent and unpredictable in voting patterns. I simply state that fact. And they've tended very heavily to vote Democratic. So it was concerned with security, not lifestyle issues. When these women were asked, why are you voting Republican? I feel safer. It had nothing to do with gay marriage. It had a lot to do with 9/11 and the Republicans' ability continually to present themselves as the party that's more effective and reliable on defense.
What does, you know, earlier in the program, we talked about the religion of two would-be presidents of the United States. And every 4 years, it seems to me that at some point during the campaign, there is a discussion of religion. And your area of expertise, obviously, is foreign affairs. And we've been talking about, you know, obviously Islam and how Islam responds to the West and what many of the radical Islamists feel about the United States. When we have states that have gay marriage or civil unions or women's rights, which obviously have dominated politics for the last 30 plus years in this country, how do those discussions, those domestic political discussions we have, how do they play in a broad world that may view the United States as too secular, irreligious? That's the question. It's a big question. I want everybody to think about it. We're going to pause and we're going to...
You want a big answer.
I want a big answer. We got 15 minutes in the next segment and we're going to talk about it, but we're going to pause right now. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont from Coast to Coast and Border to Border every Sunday night right here on this great radio station. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289. Art Sear, I asked you the question before the break. The way in which our laws have changed as it relates to gay marriage and even women's rights in this country, how does that play to a part of the world that views the United States as being too secular anyway?
Actually, we're quite religious compared to a lot of the rest of the world, especially major industrial nations, Europe and Japan and others. I think the rest of the world is increasingly comfortable with us because the rest of the world increasingly has representative democracy and the rule of law. 30 years ago, there were very, very few real democracies in Mexico. Even in Latin America, even Mexico was a one-party state. There were a couple in Central America, but nothing stable. Now, except for Cuba, you have a remarkable spread of democracy throughout that continent. Even Hugo Chavez in Venezuela has to answer to the people, and he's lost a couple times. Even Russia, the regime loses and has dramatically in court recently, and they have elections that aren't our kind of honest elections, but they're not a totalitarian state. So I think the world is moving our way. Women are rising dramatically to positions of prominence and power, including in parliaments in Uganda and other parts of the world where it's quite amazing. So the world's moving our way. I try to communicate this to undergraduates, and I think it's important for the rest of us to keep this in mind, too. We live in a remarkably positive time.
John?
Bruce, I think you've hit on a really big topic internationally, because I think if all you knew about American society was what we broadcast out there, I know we're here in the Museum of Broadcasting, if all you knew is what we put out there in terms of sex and violence, part of America's commercial culture, you probably would have a very different, warped view of American culture and society and what we value. And I think that's part of our problem with the Muslim world. I think they get snatches of our TV, our media, our commercial culture, and they think, well, you treat your women as whores. Well, actually, no, we don't, but yes, we do allow pornography. And I think a lot of cultures have trouble, squaring that circle of how a heterogeneous society actually works. And I think you've touched on something that really gets to the part of a lot of this East meets West problem that we're going through today.
I don't know how we continue to live in the world that we live in the country we live in, that obviously celebrates pluralism. When those that are willing to die and fly into buildings to kill us will never understand that.
Sure.
I don't think there will ever be a compromise where they will be able to accept that. And that's where I think some of the religious fanaticism that we talk about in faraway places. There are some that say that's not very far from some of the religious fanaticism that we were maybe talking about earlier in this broadcast, when you have people that just, there's no way in the world that they will even give a second thought to even considering, voting for a Mormon because they disagree with their religion. And some of their positions are similar.
But admittedly, it's a far, far cry between the kind of fanaticism that takes innocent human life and the kind of strongly held beliefs, let's say, that might keep someone from voting for a candidate. I think the issue in this country, Bruce, is that there is a place for peaceful dissent, regardless of what that dissent might be. As soon as it turns violent, like it does in many other places, that becomes a problem, and we don't have it as much.
Let's go to a call. Let's go to Robert listening. He's driving and listening to us on KBOI out of Boise, Idaho. Go ahead. You're on the air, Robert.
Yes, I just wanted to ask a question about what it is whenever you bring up religion. Most talk show hosts, kind of like the third rail of politics, you guys shy away from it. But my point about religion is I have nothing against the Mormon Church. Some of the nicest people I've ever met are Mormon. But between Romney and Harry Reid, they both belong to the same religion, and if you look at their views, they're not that far apart. And in my opinion, Harry Reid's still in the politics right now because of the LDS Church. You go to Nevada, it's probably 60% Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the NIU that kept him in office. Why isn't that a point?
Well, I think, first of all, we did talk about it for about 15 minutes this evening, and again, I don't think we've shied away from it. I mean, it is a significant factor. It dominated the last presidential cycle when at least Romney had to defend that. I mean, I frankly thought we were sort of beyond that, but again, it's when you have so many people who are part at least of the Republican primary base, many of whom are very, very religious people. And by the way, I am not suggesting that everyone who is conservative or religious is bigoted. That was where I took exception to some things that John was saying. They have a difference of opinion as it relates to one's religion. And to them, it may be more important that someone of their religion is nominated than basically giving someone else who is of a different religion an opportunity to become president of the United States, whether they be Catholic or Jewish or Mormon in the case of our discussion earlier. Nick, you want to add anything more to that?
No, I think you said it perfectly.
Okay. On that note, the theme song is a-playing. It means that we're at the end of hour number one. Our phone number is 1-800-723-8289, and hour number one, we have been joined by John McCarron, who is an adjunct professor of journalism at DePaul University on Chicago's fashionable Near North Side. Art Sear joins us. He is the A.W. Clawson Professor from Carthage College. That is in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And Nick Zitzen, who is the Chief Operating Officer of the Bronner Group, and a former aide to Mitt Romney, who once upon a time was Mitt Romney's driver. And we have learned tonight that Mitt Romney is a backseat driver. But you were the front seat driver. He was supposed to be in the back.
He absolutely was.
Okay, we'll learn more insight into Mitt Romney when we continue the next hour of our broadcast. Again, if you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. If you're listening to us on radio, stay right where you are. We'll be back after Network News. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Nick Zitzen, John McCarron, and political science professor Art Sear. Our program tonight, coming to you from our new home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address, btb@museum.tv, and the World Wide Web. If you want to join us on the web, it's www.beyondthebeltway.com. Art Sear is one of our guests this evening. He is the A.W. Clawson Professor at Carthage College. Art, nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Bruce.
My question to you, you have been guesting on this program for a long, long time. You were here at the beginning of our involvement in Afghanistan. How would you assess your opinion on the way our war has been conducted in Afghanistan, and is the president acting correctly by pulling troops out, and should he be pulling them out at a faster pace or slower pace?
Well, thank you for your complimentary words, and I appreciate being invited back. I don't have any inside information, and there are far too many professors especially who second-guess policymakers. I think it's good that we're withdrawing. He is being consistent. It was a major theme in his campaign to both emphasize Iraq and to organize a withdrawal. I was a little startled by Admiral Michael Mullen's very blunt comments before Congress, unusual and I think, as we say nowadays, inappropriate for a senior military leader directly disagreeing with the president, even though he couched his language diplomatically, which is why he's chairman. I think we have to withdraw at some point. As far as one can tell, the Allied forces, it's not just an American effort, the Allied forces have been extremely effective. I feel very much for the young people who've served there. I've had a chance to meet some of them because of my work at the college. Suicide, post-traumatic stress, the problems that go along with combat involvement historically are under-discussed and under-reported, except by our outgoing Secretary of Defense. I think, among many other reasons, taking the pressure off the people who are on the line is a big reason for withdrawing.
John McCarron, as you assess, you come from the political left. Is the Obama policy war policy, wars policy, is it a complete waste? Is it a complete mess up?
I'd have to say, yeah. As you say, coming from the left and having been politicized during the Vietnam era, I'm a baby boomer, and I can't believe it was so quickly after Vietnam that we thought we could go wading into a third world culture, in this case one that it may be like moving from the 17th into the 18th century and do nation building. I mean, I thought we agreed 20 years ago that we weren't in the business of nation building, that the Defense Department was about defending the United States of America. But it seems like all that has been forgotten, especially by a president that, at least I'm told by all my Republican friends, is an extreme liberal socialist pacifist kind of guy. And here, as you say, we're in, I think depending on how you want to count them, we're in five wars right now, Bruce. Very disappointed.
Nick Zitzen is our Republican tonight. The growing isolationism that we're hearing in the Republican primary debates Is that something you would like to hear more of? And do you personally feel we're at a point now where we should be speeding up the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan and really questioning why we are in Libya at all?
Well, I'd like to say, first and foremost, that I'm not a military expert, and I make a real effort when I comment publicly to not question people who are far more in the loop than am I on sensitive issues as relates to intelligence that would hopefully inform our policy. Now, having said that, I think Libya presents a real stark challenge for the president, given that his nuanced style of communication doesn't naturally suit to international affairs. I think the American people are far more used to a very clear-cut, here's what we're doing and here's why we're doing it. I think that's what they got out of Ronald Reagan. It's what they got out of George W. Bush. And I think in a case like this where you have Congress saying, we'd like you to get our approval and you haven't, and in fact when he asked they gave him no such approval, but they won't cut off the funding. President more than ever has to be clear about what we're doing, where we're doing it, and why we're doing it. And I don't know that he's done that adequately yet.
Art, did the Obama administration misread the message of the Arab Spring?
No, I don't think so. We don't know what the end of this fascinating and very important train of events will be. Also, in fairness to the president,
what was Libya then? What was Libya, in your view?
I think the airstrikes in Libya have been collaborating with NATO allies. It was the Italians and the French who were most anxious that we participate, and we did it for alliance reasons. I think those were good reasons. No war has ever been won by air power alone, and I think the president's been appropriately limited in what he said. In fairness to him, he inherited Afghanistan. These things are related, as your reference to the Arab Spring.
He inherited Afghanistan,
yeah.
But he said during the war is that's where we draw the line in our war against terrorism. Iraq was not important. Afghanistan was the place where we had to draw the line. And now we're seeing him say that he wants to pull troops out of Afghanistan. My follow-up question is what is on the subject of Libya.
Right.
And what prompted my question is, did he misread the Arab Spring?
Clearly, no, he didn't.
Well, then why did we go into Libya? What was the Libya?
For allied reasons that were not directly related to the populist uprisings throughout the region. Excuse me for interrupting.
No, I was just going to say Libya was a classic rock and a hard place. Libya was a massacre averted. If you remember, Gaddafi's army was marching in strength on Benghazi against a very unorganized and inferior rebel group, and there were all indications from the history of this guy that would have been another Serbs take Srebrenica kind of massacre, if not almost like a tribal genocide. So can you imagine, Bruce, what the Republicans would be saying now if Obama had said, no, hands off, we're not going in, we're not going to start what was then the Fourth War?
Didn't he believe at that time, and again, we assume that he's getting good intelligence advice, but did he not believe, at least for a portion of time when he making that decision, is that he thought that the popular uprising in Libya was something that was following in the wake of what happened in Tunisia and what happened in Egypt? And frankly, he misread the crowd.
We're all misreading the crowd. There's a tendency, I think, in American foreign affairs to oversimplify. And we've certainly seen that in the Arab Spring. I mean, each one of these countries, if we can even call them countries, and I think you get back to, these were lines drawn on a map at the Treaty of Versailles. We look at tribal uprisings as, there are young men yearning to be free and form Jeffersonian democracies. Not so, but it's a sort of the simplistic attitude of Americans toward foreign policy.
I want to follow up on that. Art, you've been nodding your head in disagreement with some things that were said, primarily by myself. We'll hear what that's all about when we come back. 1-800-723-8029. Afghanistan, Libya. Are you supporting the policy or against it? Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Let's go to Highland Park. That's in Illinois. It's also in Michigan. I think this one is from Illinois. Listening to us on WLS. Ben, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, Highland Park, Illinois. I think it's a mistake to withdraw from Afghanistan on this artificial timetable. If there's one thing we know, it's that the terrorists and the people who harbor them aren't operating on a four-year election cycle timetable. They're perfectly happy to wait us out until we withdraw, and then they can reform these terrorist training camps. I think the president did this to appeal to the anti-war left, to the anti-circumcision crowd, to the peaceniks. I just don't get why the artificial withdrawal timetable.
Art, is it a good idea to give this so much advance warning to get pulling out of troops?
I think you can argue it both ways. There are many, many profound differences between Afghanistan and Vietnam. The differences are in our favor. But I'm not going to deliver a lecture on the subject. One of the similarities is indigenous population. The males are not serving, and there are lots of problems with corruption and using generous supplies for the black market. We're pressuring the allied regime in Kabul to do more and do more in a serious way. So in that sense, it could be a plus. There's no evidence, in contrast to Vietnam, there's no evidence that the Taliban is at all popular with the local population, quite the reverse. And inevitably, a foreign alien presence and lots of firepower, although we're relatively restrained in Afghanistan, from what I understand, creates enemies as well as killing them. So for all kinds of reasons, it's understandable we're withdrawing. And I think the American people are right not to tolerate a foreign occupation indefinitely there.
In the last, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
In the last hour of the broadcast, we were talking about on our discussion of budgets and you know, what's an excessive budget cut. Mm-hmm. One of the issues that comes up whenever we discuss that issue on this program is someone will call up and talk about all of the bases we have all over the world and why it's necessary for us to continue to have those bases in faraway places where whether it is Japan, whether it is Germany, or 19 other places that mm-hmm. we couldn't even name because we couldn't maybe even find them on the map. As our foreign policy guy on the table this evening, defend those bases. Why are they important for us now? How do they affect our national security?
They're important for two reasons. A source of economic support. We're like the Roman Empire. We live off the occupied territories because in 1966, Lyndon Baines Johnson in the White House pressured, cajoled, charmed, browbeat, bullied, and scared the Germans especially, but all, who had 300,000 of our troops at the time, but also the Japanese with substantial naval facilities and the Koreans and others to pay the local expenses. In fact, for a period of time, we could not have afforded, especially in the 70s, to bring those people home. We were paying their salaries and retirement benefits and health insurance, but everything else was paid for by the locals. That argument still applies residually. Secondly, especially at the tough and tight and dangerous DMZ, I just got back from South Korea, at the 38th parallel, there is an important symbolic presence. But we are gradually withdrawing our forces. We're under 50,000 in Germany. I learned when I was in Korea, talking to some defense and military types, that we are, in fact, steadily withdrawing our South Korean forces.
Do you think that we are, do you support that at this particular time?
Yes.
Okay. So we're fairly safe there?
I believe there has not been a general war, thank God, since Eisenhower achieved the armistice in 1953, despite sporadic violence and killing initiated by the North, suicide squads, sinking a naval corvette, shelling an island within the last year. There's been no return to general war.
Let's go back to calls. Let's go back to George listening to us in Downers Grove on our flagship station, WLS Radio. Go ahead.
Your screener prompted me very carefully. I'll make my point real fast.
Thank you.
We get no oil out of Libya. Europe gets almost 100% of it at the present time. Europe has not given enough military aid to NATO, and of that aid that they have promised, they have only delivered a fraction. My point would be they have the skin in the game. We don't. We shouldn't be there in the first place. We're doing their job, and they're cheating on us, as they cheated on us in the past. Thank you. Goodbye.
I would agree with the caller on that score. I think many of the NATO nations have been free riding on behind our coattails for a long time. But in the Libyan situation, we have some capabilities: satellite surveillance, smart smart weaponry that, frankly, is not widely available throughout NATO. Maybe it should be. Maybe it's time they started playing with the big boys, so they're not looking to the United States to do all the high tech stuff.
You know, to your question about bases, for all my talk about hoping for American politics that doesn't politicize national security, anytime someone tries to cut the Department of Defense budget, there is no more political exercise in Washington, D.C., whether that means bases around the world, bases in the U.S., weapons systems. Bruce, the Defense Department's budget is so substantial, and the impact on American jobs in the areas where those bases are located or where the weapons are manufactured, it is an inherently political exercise trying to manage the country's defense agenda, our national security agenda, in the context of the budget that's spent on those resources.
So I also heard you say that if we're bringing those troops home, mm-hmm. some of those troops, you know, they may choose to leave their military service if they don't like serving domestically. And you're saying that would lead to more unemployment? That's one of your concerns? Is that would?
No, I didn't mean to say that, if that's the way it came across. We're talking
but
about relatively small numbers of people.
Yes.
And the defense budget itself is only about 20% of federal spending. Into the 60s, it was over 50%. Eisenhower dealt with a far more challenging situation. He was a much better manager than anyone who's come since. The misallocation is more of concern to me, and this tremendous support for hardware, heavy weapon systems while our troops are being shortchanged.
I've asked this to some of our liberals that have been in your seat over the last couple of months, John. I want to get your take on it. The intensity that Barack Obama was able to generate from the left anti-war crowd, which propelled him to the Democratic nomination, and certainly was part of the euphoria, the unique historic euphoria that swept him into the White House. You are not alone in being a liberal on this program who is disappointed with his foreign policy. So my question to you is, what is the likelihood that there's going to be a dissipation of just interest? You may vote for Barack Obama for re-election, but the intensity of people who maybe aren't as day in, day out, as politically engaged as you are those people going to stay home? Because you know what? Barack Obama, they walked the walk for Barack Obama, and in their view, Barack Obama did not bring the change that they hoped he would, especially in foreign policy, because much of his foreign policy mm-hmm. is a continuation of the Bush policy.
There is disappointment out there, and there's going to be more in the months ahead. There's going to be disappointment when we find out what domestic discretionary programs the president is willing to throw under the bus in order to get a deal with Boehner, et cetera, et cetera. However, there's also going to be a Republican primary, and as we discussed earlier, I argued that they're going to send up perhaps a Michelle Bachmann or a Pawlenty or maybe even a Romney. But by that time, he will have had to take such drastic right-wing positions that he will be absolutely abhorrent to the Democratic center and left, and I think there will be a new birth of enthusiasm for President Obama as we head for the general election.
Are you worried that Romney is going to be sucked too far to the right?
No, not at all.
Is that a lesson he learned from 4 years ago?
I believe so, and I believe he made that strategic choice in 2008 only to see John McCain, who no one would argue is a conservative's conservative, win the Republican nomination. I think Mitt Romney is going to stay staunchly conservative when it comes to economic issues. I think you'll see him tout his plans to get the economy back on track, to put people back to work. I think he'll be thoughtful on national security, but I don't think he's going to fall into that trap again, which is why I think the president has a real problem, because I think you're going to have a viable mainstream Republican come out of this field who can appeal to conservatives, but who can bring voters in the political middle back into the equation, which makes his path to reelection a whole lot
harder. But the albatross that he carries at this moment is that he is the father of Romney Care, which many Republicans view as the kiss of death, and even Pawlenty obviously has referred to it in a derogatory way, although obviously not having the guts to call it, say it like it was when he was 2 feet away from the guy.
I think it's a fair challenge. Mitt's got to deal with it. But I'll tell you this. If we get into a habit in this country of making people who have served in elected office regret or resent everything they ever did while they were there, we're going to end up with people in the White House with no experience. Oh, wait.
That's a great line. That's a great line. I hope Governor Romney uses it. I think that's an ideal
question
retort.
Question to you. You were in Massachusetts when Romney Care evolved, correct?
I was at HHS at the time, okay. But yes.
But you were watching what was happening with your old boss. Mm-hmm. What happened? What should he have done?
Oh, I think he should have done exactly what he did, Bruce. I mean, this is a different time in the country. There was no viable state model for health care reform. Mitt Romney is a smart, engaging executive. He looked at a series of problems. He decided he wanted to fix one of them. He brought in smart people from the right and the left. He struck a compromise, and he got a bill passed. That's what governors in this country should do. No one could have known at the time that this was going to be the path that took place. No one could have known that the president was going to use that as a model without asking Romney. So I think he should have done exactly what he should do, what he did. Excuse me.
Brenda, listening to us in Austin, Texas, is our next caller, but we're going to hear from her when we come back on the other side. 1-800-723-8289. And wherever you're listening, you're probably asking your question. What is Brenda going to bring up for discussion? Stand by. From Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to Anchorage, Alaska, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway on America's Great Talk radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM satellite radio. John McCarron is here. He is an adjunct professor of journalism at DePaul University, having spent over 30 years with the Chicago Tribune as a reporter, as a columnist, and as a member of their editorial board. Nick Zitzen also joins us. He is the chief operating officer of the Bronner Group, and once upon a time, he was an aide not only to Tommy Thompson at HHS, but he was an aide to Mitt Romney. He was also the head of the Republican Party in Massachusetts. And by the way, let me just ask a quick question. You mentioned in the first hour that you met Mitt. You were one of the first people to get on his campaign when he was running for governor, and you ended up with a job, and you worked with him on appointments. You also told us you drove for him for a while. How did you move from being a driver and the head of the appointments office? And it wasn't, I mean, you were looking for people to recommend to be on commissions. It wasn't like you were taking notes at the meeting. We'll clarify that. But how did you get to become the political director of the state party?
Well, actually, that was first. The political director of the state party was at the time when he was being recruited to run for governor of Massachusetts.
Okay.
And then from there, I joined the campaign, Romney for governor. And then from the campaign, obviously went to the governor's office.
Okay, very good. And Art Sear also joins us. Yeah. He is the A.W. Clawson Professor. That is a distinguished professorship at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And speaking of Wisconsin, let's go to Joe, who's listening to us in Wisconsin. Or are you listening in Wisconsin or in Gurnee, Illinois?
Yeah. I just want to remind everybody, back in 2010, President Obama was told that by the commanders in the field that they needed at least 40,000 more troops in a surge in order to guarantee long-term victory here. He ignored that. He sent 30,000, 10,000 less than the bare-bones minimum needed, and now he's ignoring their advice once again. Make of it what you will, but the facts are there.
Art, the caller is correct. I mean,
may come back to haunt him. It's pretty unusual to find a military commander going back to the earliest years of the Republic, who wants fewer troops. Military people tend to want more, and the president is the ultimate decision maker.
Yes, he is, and he has zippity-doo for military understanding and expertise. He's ignoring the people who are charged with and educated in the field that is required to make a rational decision.
But the ultimate authority, I'm not disagreeing with you, sir, and it may come back to haunt him, it may defeat him, and 2012.
He's making a political decision.
If I could just finish my sentence, sir, it may come back to haunt him in the 2012 election, but we do have civilian leadership and ultimate civilian authority.
But again, the comparison, what the caller is making is that when John McCain was making his case to George Bush, that we needed a surge. It took President Bush a while to come to the conclusion, but he ultimately supported the surge, and that proved to be successful. That was a surge that was opposed by Barack Obama as a U.S. senator.
That's a very good point. It was also opposed by Don Rumsfeld in the Defense Department from day one. Actually, I'm very glad you mentioned that, Bruce. I think it's very insightful. Civil-military relations were a lot worse during the Rumsfeld tenure than they've been with Secretary of Defense Bob Gates, who I think will leave a huge hole in the Obama administration. But you're absolutely right. That's a very good point. I wish I'd made that point.
But Gates, you've just given him accolades. But, I mean, yeah. Gates was not able to convince the president on this rather significant issue that maybe the troops should stay there a little bit longer.
And
he didn't make the case that maybe the generals should have gotten what they wanted.
I don't think we know what Gates said, because as what we used to refer to as a dedicated public servant who doesn't appear to leak to the press, we don't know what his personal advice was to the president.
Well, there'll be none of that. We don't want one of those, for
heaven's
sakes.
Yeah. No,
we'll never know what's going on.
He's been very disciplined, and I honestly don't know what he said, but he sure as hell doesn't just rubber stamp what the military industrial complex and the brass wants. And I applaud him for that.
No, but the other point that the caller was making is that initially the president decided to send 10,000 fewer troops.
Sure.
And now he's taking out 10,000 more. So that's a significant cut in the troops that were sent there as part of his surge to get something done.
It's in line with what he has said in the past in his earlier public statement on the subject. I not only agree with you, I agree with the caller, in that the Republicans are consistently ahead of the Democrats when it comes to national security. That's been true for a number of years. Even in 2008, McCain and the Republicans were seen by voters at a time when the Democrats were sweeping the boards and everything else. Polls showed voters trusted Republicans on defense. Caller is right on that.
We asked the question before the break what Brenda in Austin, Texas, had on her mind. She's listening to us on KLBJ. You need not wait any longer.
Very
Brenda,
patient.
Speak. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
I have a question. What do you consider an evangelical?
What is an evangelical to you, John?
I would say it is someone who's sort of gets out of the bed in the morning, try to convince others that they have the way, the truth, and the light, and want to bring more members into the fold.
And so
the
how...
Say again?
The Mormons do that.
Yeah, religion do that? Isn't that what Muslims do? I mean, they try to proselytize.
Muslims, yes. Yes, they do.
I think the answer that you may be looking for is evangelicals are Protestants, obviously. They are people that believe in a very strict interpretation of the Bible and the Word of God. They believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and they believe in prayer. They believe that if you do bad deeds, you will go to hell, and you will stay there.
I think you're describing fundamentalism.
Yeah, but fundamentalism and evangelicalism, I think, usually are used synonymously, at least by the secular press. And they are conservative in their views insofar as marriage is concerned, and a variety of other divorce and things of that nature.
But I think the crucial variable and factor is their religion trumps their politics. They not only proselytize aggressively, which not all fundamentalists do, but also their strong religious fervor drives the definition of their politics. You could define Jimmy Carter as a fundamentalist in one sense. But if you're going to succeed in our system, you've got to make it clear to the American people, as John Kennedy did to the Baptist bishops in Texas in 1960, I'm not the Catholic candidate. I'm the Democratic nominee who happens to be a Catholic. You've got to underscore separation of church and state, and evangelicals don't want to do that.
They also, I think, the secular media purports that they are the most organized of the religions or elements of religion in the United States. I don't know whether that is true or not, but I think the perception is that they are, because it's really, it's only the activity of evangelicals that seem to me that get watched closely by the media every 4 years. We want to know how certain voters are playing with the evangelical right. Well, I don't remember having discussions by the secular media saying, well, how are the Jews going to react to this candidate, or how are the Catholics reporting to this candidate? What about the Episcopalians? We'll never get to get the Episcopalians. It's always singularly. Well, am I right?
Well, they're kind of at the other extreme, aren't they? The Episcopalians.
this guy can't win because the Greek Orthodox, they're going to go, no way with this guy. It's always, for the last 20 years. And I think because of the success of the Moral Majority and their involvement in helping elect Ronald Reagan, the only religious group in America that gets that type of political scrutiny are the evangelicals, because they're organized. They also tend to have religious beliefs that are different from the vast majority of people who sit in America's newsrooms and who make news decisions, who are not evangelicals.
We were very lucky to have Bruce Dumont visit Carthage College. We've had other media people, including a very well-known...
And I'd be delighted to come back.
Well, I look forward to it, and there were others there do too. But we had another well-known figure from a national network visit us, and he mentioned to me off the record as I was driving him back to the airport, and we were talking about religion and the fact that we're a Lutheran school. He said, I don't know anybody who goes to church at the network. We're not religious, as far as I know. And he was pretty convinced that it wasn't because of a professional separation of job and personal life. You see, religious people don't go in to major national network news or anything else nowadays. He said it is a separate culture. And this guy is no right-wing conservative.
Right.
He wouldn't have been at the network.
John, your reaction to my...
Well, I think you're overstating
a long answer.
I think you're overstating the case a little bit. I think when Karl Rove sat down with George Bush and said, we could win this thing by putting together the evangelicals, we could win the primary, and you could be president. I think that was a transcendent moment in American politics, because he was right, because he understood that these people were organized and they were willing to take voters.
But George Bush also believed what they believed as an evangelical. George Bush was a born-again Christian.
He's a recovered alcoholic, Bruce, is what he is. And a lot of people find Jesus down the bottom of the whiskey barrel.
That is correct. And that's one of the elements of being evangelical that George Bush was able to tap into, because I don't believe that George Bush was faking the born again experience in the man's life. I think it defined his presidency. Whether you like it or not, I think it did. 1-800-723-8289. If you are a born again Christian or you're an evangelical and you want to disagree or agree with what I just said, give me a buzz. 1-800-723-8289.
Brenda has the patience of Job.
Yes, she does. Bruce Dumont back. Let us go to Crete, Illinois, where John is listening to us on WLS. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. I want to talk about when John Kennedy went to Texas, he says, as far as separation of church and state, that his religion cannot have any effect on his politics. It took 50 years later for Cardinal Shapur, the Catholic, to say, yes, if he's a Catholic, in particular about birth control, that when Sean Kennedy mentioned, he was wrong in saying that his religion had no effect, should have no effect on his politics. That's my comment.
Art Sear, you want to comment on that?
I don't think religion had much effect on his politics. And in some ways, he was a remarkably secular leader and very good for popping the balloon of prejudice generally, which we were discussing off the air.
Let's go to George in Pawnee, Illinois, listening to us on WMAY in Central Illinois. In fact, now I understand. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. What I want to focus on is I'm an evangelical as a Roman Catholic, okay? Born again. Yeah, I got dunked elsewhere, but still, I grew up Roman Catholic. What I don't like is the left-wing media gives what's going on what's been going on in the Roman Catholic Church since 1969 due to Saul the Red Alinsky, that he helped get the Catholic Campaign for Human Development fund started and that money was siphoned off into the Industrial Areas Foundation, which is all part of the leftist community organizations. What they do is they give money off to ACORN, which has been stopped by the Roman Catholic Church. But ACORN keeps changing their name. They also give it off to other left-wing causes that support abortion rights, gay rights, gay marriage, amnesty for legal aliens, pro-prostitution legislation in California, and also to help elect pro-choice Democrats. You know, that's not what the money that the people are being duped in the Roman Catholic Church, which the scandal still was continuing last fall, and I'm sure they'll trot it out again to help out the Democrats here coming up in Thanksgiving 2011, they'll trot that fund, that campaign fund out again, collection. And will some of that money go into 2012 to reelect Barack Obama, who was trained by the Gamelli Foundation by an ex-Jesuit priest by the name of Greg Galuzzo, all part of the liberation theology crowd, which Barack Obama is part of the black liberation theology crowd.
Jeremiah Wright. Yeah,
That's not right. That is fraud.
All right, let's let John McCarron talk about it.
No, I was just going to relate a personal thing. When I was in high school, I wanted to have political opinions and get involved in this sort of ideology thing. And so I became a devotee of the John Birch Society, which had an American Opinion Library, as they were called, in my hometown of Lombard, Illinois.
Belmont, Massachusetts.
And it was beautiful because there were all these interrelationships of people, and the single answer to all the world's problems was, of course, we've got to do something about the international communist conspiracy. So I got over it eventually. I learned a little economics. I learned a little political science. I learned that it's not black and white. Most of the world is shades of gray. So all I have to say to you, Mr. Pawnee, is get over it.
Get over it while the scandal keeps going on.
Yeah, get over it.
Fraud is a good idea. Yeah. You're okay. Part of the liberation theology crowd.
Okay, listen, thanks for your call. Travis in El Paso, Texas. Listening to us on KTSM. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to make a quick point that Christians believe you're saved by grace, not by your works. Evangelicalism is being saved by grace. And so you mentioned George Bush, being an alcoholic, but saved by grace, and that anybody, no matter how bad they have been, can be redeemed, because it's not our righteousness, but the righteousness of Jesus Christ that empowers us to have a changed life. And that's a point that a lot of people miss, and they get focused on the works, and they make it all about what man can do. But it's hard for people who don't believe in God to understand how that works, because they all think it's about them.
Travis, can you explain to the audience, for those people who are not born-again Christians or evangelicals, and many of them are in the media that I'm stating for this question, they view the staunch, devout religious belief that you have, they describe it as intolerance. Can you explain to those listening tonight why it's not intolerant in your view?
It is not intolerant because the Bible actually says that we should show tolerance. But it also teaches that the wages of sin is death. Now, if I go and engage myself in the acts of sinful behavior, then I know that that's going to bring consequences on my life. But he says the gift of God is eternal life. So when I trust Christ, he gives me power. Now, to those people who don't agree with me, I engage in conversations with them all the time in my workplace. And it's the hardest thing I have to do is explain that question that you just articulated, because they think that it's my power, it's me that's saying that you have to be like me, you have to. But
do you feel obsessed? Again, let's say you work with someone who is homosexual. Do you feel obsessed that you have to convert them out of their lifestyle to support your religious beliefs? I can only give you 20 seconds to answer it.
I understand. Whenever that person comes to faith in Christ, the Bible says that they will not continuing those things. But the problem is, we have a culture that believes that we are born either good people or bad people, and the Bible teaches that we're all born in sin. So I say it's the same thing for a heterosexual sin or alcoholic sin or lying sin. Jesus wants to save you from all of those things.
Okay, on that note,
homosexuality is just one of many sins.
On that note, we are out of time. Travis, thanks very much for your call, our last one for the evening. John McCarron has been with us, Art Sear from Carthage College. Nick Zitzen has been our Republican, strong supporter of Mitt Romney. Wearing the Romney button on our program this evening. You can't see it. It's invisible for those listening to us on radio. This program is a Gen V production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. And thanks to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman and Mark Glick for their assistance in the production of this program. Have a wonderful 4th of July holiday weekend. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back next week.